You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hey, Connor. How you doing?
Hey, Andrew. I'm good. How about you?
I'm doing well today. Thank you. Let me introduce ourselves. I'm Andrew Day. You are Connor Eccles. And this is Earthling Unplugged, where we talk about the weekend edition of Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter on Substack and important stories of the week. Robert Wright himself will be joining us in 30 minutes or so, though most of that segment will be behind the paywall. So if you want to listen to that, listeners, you should become an NZN member at the Non-Zero newsletter on Substack to gain access to full podcast episodes. Our first item in today's issue of The Earthling includes a video sermonette by Bob in which he talks about the election and the best way for people on the blue team to react to Trump's various provocations and outrages going forward when Trump becomes president again. It remains to be seen whether Trump's pretty incredible political comeback, which he completed this week, will be accompanied by a full-scale version of, you know, comeback of the resistance or, you know, resistance liberalism. But we know at least one person who doesn't particularly like Trump, Bob himself, will be practicing what he calls mindful resistance, which Bob advocated in 2016 after the first Trump victory. And Bob is now advocating again after Trump's re-election. And in the sermonette, Bob gives some useful tips to liberals and other never-Trumpers on how to maintain their poise and equanimity and how to avoid feeding the trolls. Trump is very good at inciting liberal outrage that sometimes makes some liberals seem a little unhinged, at least in the eyes of Trump supporters. So again, that's the first item in today's newsletter. Later in the episode, we'll be talking to Bob about it and other ramifications of this week's election. Maybe we'll also talk to him about an AI-related essay that he recently wrote. But Connor, which story of the week do you want to talk about first?
Yeah, the first one I wanted to highlight is a big story that's gotten, actually, it's gotten a decent amount of play for people who follow the Gaza issue closely, but you might have missed it if you were paying close attention to the election this week, which was, of course, the biggest news. But earlier this week, either on Monday or Tuesday, an Israeli general made a few comments that basically, so the exact quote was that there are no more civilians left in the area north of Gaza City, and that the IDF does not have any intention of allowing civilians back into that area. So that is the last kind of few miles of the Gaza Strip along the northern section. This was received by a lot of people as sort of an admission of ethnic cleansing. Forced displacement would be the official term for that, which is, of course, the idea that you remove a population from an area through military means and don't allow them to return. The Israeli military has argued that that was taken out of context and that those quotes were not necessarily indicating long-term policy, but it's nonetheless caused a lot of concern, especially because, as a lot of people have noted, it's not at all clear that all of the civilians have actually been cleared out of that area. So it raises questions among a lot of observers about whether the Israeli military is going to now treat people who may be civilians in that area as military combatants. So we may have more to say about this and about also Israel's decision to ban the primary UN organization that provides aid within Gaza later in this conversation. But I'm going to go ahead and throw it back now to you, Andrew, if you have another item that you want to highlight.
Sure. Before I do that, I've forgotten. Sorry if you said this. Did that general make that comment before or after the election results came in?
It was before the election was settled, for sure. I don't remember the exact timing, but it was so that the comments came during a roundtable with Israeli press. It was published as kind of a normal press line. It was not seen by Israeli press as a particularly unusual thing, but people in the West have seen it as quite damning.
Interesting. And something that happened on election day, America's election day, is Netanyahu fired Yoav Gallant, the defense minister. I guess you couldn't call him a moderate, but he was saying that he thinks Israel should get out of Gaza and like pursue this hostage deal, which would entail a ceasefire. So that's interesting. I'll move on to Russia-Ukraine because we have a development this week. For the first time, Ukrainian forces clashed with North Korean troops who were sent to Russia last month to help Russia's war effort. That's according to Ukrainian officials who made the announcement early this week. A couple weeks ago, the U.S. government said that around 3,000 North Korean soldiers had traveled to Russia in the month of October for training and possibly combat against Ukraine. The U.S., Ukrainian, and South Korean governments all seemed to agree at that time that a total of 10 to 12,000 North Korean troops were expected to travel to Russia for military training. But until this week, it was still unclear whether North Korean troops actually would join in combat against Ukraine. And if so, whether they'd be deployed inside Ukrainian territory, or would they fire on Ukraine from Russian territory, or would they fight Ukrainians inside Russia in the Kursk region, which Ukraine invaded in August, I believe. Some analysts suspected that it would be the latter, that the North Korean soldiers would do their fighting in Kursk, because this summer, Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un signed a mutual defense pact, and some people said that North Koreans fighting Ukrainians inside Russia would seem to fall under the purview of that new pact. I mean, it seems those analysts were right. The Ukrainian officials say the fighting took place in the Kursk region. We don't know exactly when it took place, but they have made the announcement this week. Those officials said it was small-scale, limited engagement. The U.S. officials say a significant number of North Korean troops were killed. I read that in the New York Times. So this conflict is officially internationalized. A third country has joined the fight, not in the form of individual volunteers or military advisors, but by actually deploying troops. And previously, Zelensky had said that would constitute the first step toward World War III. So hopefully he wasn't right about that. So that's the news in Russia-Ukraine this week. I'd also like to highlight this new article by Samuel Cherup and Miranda Priba of the RAND Corporation. They were looking at these claims one often hears from Western politicians that Putin, if Russia defeats Ukraine, will next have his forces march across Europe, they'll swallow up one or more of the Baltics and attack Poland and try to reconstitute the Soviet Union. And in the new article, Cherup and Priba write that this is probably not the case, that Putin intends to do this. Part of the reasoning is they say NATO's deterrent is still strong. And the collective West still will enjoy a balance of power advantage vis-a-vis Russia after the war ends. It's a good article. People who are interested in the topic should go read it. But okay, I'll kick it to you, Connor.
Yeah. So another news line I wanted to highlight here is that this week has brought us, obviously, I guess, because Trump is only elected this week, but it's brought some of the first indications of what Trump's foreign policy team or his foreign policy inclinations might look like in his second term in office. And for advocates of foreign policy restraint, it's pretty universally bad news at the start. So the first official appointment that has been made for the transition team, or that has at least been reported, is Brian Hook, who is going to be leading the transition over at the State Department. Hook, for people who follow foreign policy closely, you might remember, was Trump's kind of envoy to Iran from about, I believe, 2018 to 2020. He's known as kind of a classic GOP hawk. He has very strong sort of hardline feelings about both Iran and kind of the Middle East region in general, as well as Russia and China. So that's an indication that, if Trump has a hawkish side and a dovish side, that is an indication that his hawkish side may be winning over at the State Department. And another bit of news that we got was that Robert Wilkie will be leading up the transition over at Defense. Wilkie was Trump's VA secretary the first time around and has very similar views to Hook on a lot of these different issues. I would say that he, he's been very critical of the Biden administration for, saying that it wants a ceasefire in Lebanon and in Gaza. Wilkie has argued that Israel needs to finish the job and destroy Hamas and Hezbollah in those places. He's advocated, or at least suggested, taking on Iran more directly and treating, China and the China threat as we treated the Soviet Union during the Cold War. So those are two really concrete indications that the Trump team may be leaning in the more hawkish direction. We're going to talk more about this one later, because there are other, less concrete indications that might be more positive for people who are fans of foreign policy restraints. But those are still kind of percolating. So we'll get back to those later in the episode.
Yeah, I look forward to it. I have a couple things to say about that, especially Brian Hook. I'm not super familiar with all of the names you just mentioned, but I do know him, not personally, but I know of him. So I'll talk about another item in today's newsletter. So this week we wanted to learn what China experts had to say about which American presidential candidate Beijing wanted to win this week. Before the election, China, maybe this is obvious, but China was neutral between the candidates and its official pronouncements, and Chinese officials were rather circumspect in their language. So there weren't really strong indications that they had a preference between Trump and Harris, but some China experts think that Beijing wanted Trump to win. That's maybe a little surprising, given that Trump often talks like a hardliner on China, and given that he basically inaugurated this anti-China bipartisan consensus in his first administration. But I think that's also kind of the point. You know, both parties now are pretty hawkish on China, so Chinese officials don't see a lot of upside with Harris. And in the case of Trump, they see somebody, or some of them see somebody, that they can make a deal with. That's what Zongguan Zoe Liu of the Council on Foreign Relations told me in an interview a while back. Rush Doshi, a former Biden official, well-respected China watcher, agrees with that assessment, but thinks it's a bad thing. Like, he's critical of Trump for being too open to making deals with Beijing, I guess because he thinks Trump should focus on constraining the Chinese threat as he sees it. Another reason some China experts think Beijing preferred Trump is they consider him a known quantity. You know, they have practiced dealing with him. They're kind of risk averse when it comes to the unknown. And I just want to add as a sidebar that one thing that stuck with me after Trump's victory in 2016 is that the day afterwards, I was leading a seminar of undergraduates at Northwestern University, our mutual alma mater. And I thought, okay, obviously we have to talk about this election for at least a little bit. This is a political science class after all, and it's on everyone's minds. And it became apparent to me during that discussion that every single student I thought had voted for or supported Hillary, or at least wasn't willing to admit voting for Trump. And it became so apparent that I kind of stopped the class and invited the students to reflect on that fact. You know, how cloistered we must be if literally no one here supported the guy who wound up winning the national election. Yeah. But there was one student in the class who raised her hand and said she actually had wanted Trump to win. And she was Chinese, not Chinese American. She was Chinese, international student. She had an accent. She frankly seemed quite wealthy. I imagine her family was well-connected in China, but that's speculation. And she said that she and most Chinese people liked Trump. They admired him in some way, saw him as like a strong person, and thought he was, you know, kind of reasonable on foreign policy. So, you know, that's super anecdotal and maybe not representative, but I think that maybe there is something to this. And I also think maybe it has something to do with the impression in China that Trump is just something different than the like liberal internationalists. You know, he's not a liberal. He's not going to try to turn China into a liberal democracy because he doesn't care that much about liberal democracy. But I'm veering off course now. I just thought that anecdote was a little interesting. I'll kick it to you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that is super interesting. I think, maybe the fundamental underlying thing is that something I've heard a lot from China watchers over the years, China experts over the years, is that they don't really buy the argument that the U.S. is like a meaningful democracy and that there are meaningful differences between the parties. And so it makes a lot of sense to me that at a basic level, you know, they're going to be looking at these individual characteristics of the leaders rather than maybe the political movements around them. So that's very interesting. The last item that I wanted to do before we come back to talking about kind of the potential Trump foreign policy team is there was a good write-up this week in The Verge talking about what a Trump presidency might mean for the future of U.S. policy on electric vehicles. Basically, it looks pretty negative for people who want to have more electric vehicles in the streets and fewer internal combustion engine cars. So Trump has promised to repeal or kind of rescind the funds from the Inflation Reduction Act that are left when he enters office. That means getting rid of some of the individual federal subsidies for people who purchase new electric cars. And it also means getting rid of a lot of the kind of federal subsidies that have underpinned the manufacturing of batteries and other sort of secondary aspects of the, or important parts of the electric vehicle supply chain. Trump's also made some noises about getting rid of this federal program that subsidizes new installations of car chargers across the country. And so that could have a pretty big impact because, you know, you think about there's a gas station on every block, but car chargers, you know, are actually still pretty sparse comparatively. So that's going to be a big shift of it. Of course, you know, the X factor in all of this, the unpredictable aspect of all of this is that Donald Trump, as we've seen very clearly this past week, has a very close relationship with America's single biggest electric car magnate, Elon Musk, the owner of Tesla. Tesla has obviously benefited really greatly from these subsidies, has had, you know, probably wouldn't have become the company that it is today without a ton of federal and local subsidies to help bring down the cost of its cars, which are on the more expensive side. But what I found is interesting, and one thing that this Verge article notes, they've got a financial analyst talking about this, is that Tesla is now so big and so much more powerful than its competitors that it's actually really well positioned to survive in a post-subsidy market. So there's a lot of reason to believe that you know, Musk may not actually be that worried about these subsidies being withdrawn. They're simply less crucial to his work. So that's kind of a point against the idea that he would fight to keep the subsidies in place. And one more point against that is that Musk has a lot of other things to potentially gain from a Trump administration that aren't directly having to do with the subsidies. And those include potentially ending a federal investigation into the safety capacity of self-driving features from Tesla that have come under a good amount of controversy, as well as the potential that Musk will get Trump's help in stopping his workers from unionizing in factories in the U.S. So there's a lot of other upsides for Musk that might make him not lean too hard on Trump on EVs. So that's something to keep an eye out for over the next 4 years.
Interesting. Yeah. Trump's alliance with Elon Musk has generated some funny moments during the campaign. Because of Trump's apparent dislike of electric vehicles and the green transition generally. I don't know if you listened to the Musk-Trump conversation on X. At one point, Trump accidentally said something negative about EVs, or at least positive about gas-powered vehicles. And then he kind of had to correct himself and be like, well, I don't hate EVs. I just don't think everyone should have to drive one. So he's kind of had to kind of modulate his opposition to the green transition because of his new, you know, strongly supportive billionaire backer. Connor, you had mentioned you wanted to get back to this item that you've already discussed, and we can talk about it in more detail, which is, you know, this story about Trump's transition team and this kind of proto-administration that's coming into place as Trump picks the people who are going to be staffing these very important departments. Before I kick it to you, I just want to highlight this is like an extremely important topic for people who are interested in foreign policy. From whatever perspective you're coming to this, if you're a Trump supporter who is kind of populist and wants an America first foreign policy and no more wars in the Middle East and that kind of thing, this topic is probably especially important to you because Trump had some trouble during his first administration with governing, to be frank, in part because the people who, you know, the civil servants who staff these departments are, you know, Trump arouses their antipathy in many cases. And it matters who is in the room with Trump and what their vision is for foreign policy, because otherwise he can't execute the agenda that he claims to want to execute. And I'm interested just to hear your general thoughts. I know you've been looking more closely into this than I have been, you know, Trump's appointments. But I want to start with this general question of why is, if Trump is always talking about how he didn't start any new wars. And that's like the best thing about them. And we have all these stupid wars all over the world. And we need to stop doing that. Why does he consistently have like some of the most hawkish people in American politics on his foreign policy team, do you think? Do you have any speculation about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's that Trump is a politician who deeply understands that he needs to do things to satisfy certain constituencies. I think he is a person who has a very deep understanding of his base, both at a popular level and at an elite level. And I think that he is rationally responding to the fact that there is a really deep split on the right about what the best path forward for American foreign policy is, right? So you've got, you know, you kind of pointed to these America First, maybe populists on one side, if that is a good way to refer to them. They've often made common cause with the restraint movement, which is kind of this broad foreign policy effort to reduce America's military entanglements abroad. And these America First people, they're very prominent. J.D. Vance could probably be considered one of them. And you know, that is obviously going to be the vice president. So that's going to have a significant impact. And that, I think, is where a lot of the momentum in the GOP, like, actual base is. I think that people are really tired of the ideas of forever wars and things like that. So Trump feels like he needs to respond with appointments like J.D. Vance to that. But then at the same time, the Republican kind of elites and a certain subset of classic Republicans are very in favor of this sort of Cold War-esque view of the world in which, you know, the United States needs to be very dominant in all aspects of the globe. We need to, you know, be involved militarily to a limited extent in lots of different places in order to help deter various different forms of foreign conflict, right? And so that's the kind of more like muscular side of things. I think that these early appointments indicate that he's spending a little bit more time focused on that kind of classic hawkish GOP part of his base. But I think that, you know, I think that's rational to a certain degree. I don't think that is super surprising. And I think, you know, you got to assume that Trump thinks that he can kind of keep a lid on these things also.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, one potential silver lining here, if that's the right word, you know, Trump has said some interesting things about John Bolton and about Trump's reasoning for having John Bolton around him during the first Trump administration. I mean, basically, Trump has said that he liked having Bolton behind him because it kind of freaked out America's adversaries. It was like a way of enhancing his leverage in a bargaining sense, because they see John Bolton there and they think that guy's a nut. Like, he's going to want to nuke us. So we better try to avoid that situation. Maybe we should work with Trump because it seems like he'd be willing to go to war with us. So Trump apparently does kind of think that way, at least sometimes, about his foreign policy appointments. But I don't want to be overly optimistic. Maybe to kind of briefly establish my credibility, I guess, in the eyes of any people watching this who are Trump supporters. You know, I'm not a person of the left. I disagree with the Democrats on a lot of things about cultural issues and foreign policy, et cetera. I've written in the American Conservative an article called Only Trump Can Go to Tehran, in which I argue he's the best positioned person to broker some sort of rapprochement with Iran and get back to the Iran nuclear deal, et cetera, which is kind of weird because he's the one who got us off of that. But now I want to say the Brian Hook appointment is extremely concerning to me. Like, that indicates to me that Trump is not going to go to Tehran. This guy, I think you mentioned, he was a special envoy to Iran. He basically, as far as I can tell, supports regime change in Iran. I mean, he oversaw the maximum pressure campaign under the first Trump administration, which was intended to basically, as far as I can tell, cause enough suffering in Iran that they overthrow the regime. I mean, he now says that his former boss doesn't support regime change, and that they're just going to try to aim for like a peace through strength strategy. But let me read this quote I found from Mark Dubowitz, the CEO of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He told this to Jewish Insider. The Foundation for Defense of Democracies is like the neocon think tank par excellence. Okay, so this was relevant to people who hope Trump follows through on his promises to kind of get rid of the neocons and not have his administration staffed by them. And what Dubowitz said is, I couldn't think of a better person to lead the transition team given Brian's experience in senior roles of the State Department. Yeah, he couldn't think of a better person than Brian Hook. And I think that quote kind of speaks for itself about what we can expect with regard to Iran policy in a second Trump administration.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean, what's going to depend is, you know, there's a few more kind of X factors here that are a little complicated. One is that Trump has gotten fairly lucky that he is going to have a significant majority in the Senate, which mm-hmm. means that he is going to have less trouble if he wants to try to appoint a Secretary of State who maybe breaks with a lot of the things that some members of the GOP caucus in Congress don't want to see, right? Some of those old school guys. So he's actually got, if he's willing to make bold moves, he has more of an opportunity to do that. He's got the votes on his side to put more restraint-oriented people in. I mean, it's a complicated field for Secretary of State. And for the Secretary of Defense, frankly, there's talk of maybe Pompeo returning. There's talk of Marco Rubio. We're also seeing a lot of news lines that, you know, Donald Trump Jr., Tucker Carlson are very strongly opposing the idea of a return of any of those super hawks to those top roles. So we could end up seeing maybe even a split between, you know, if Brian Hook is the person who's handling a lot of these staffing decisions, and then Rick Grenell, for example, who is kind of an America First person, ends up being the Secretary of State, there could be sort of a kind of a schizophrenic State Department mm-hmm. Under Trump. One other thing I did want to call attention to is that we don't note this in the Earthling this week because it's still speculative. It's based on some reporting from Politico that the Trump campaign hasn't fully like announced yet or said is official yet. But apparently the pair that is going to be kind of leading the transition for the National Security Council is a real odd couple. So one of them is going to be, according to Politico again, so this is not official, but worth noting, is Joel Rayburn, who is, again, more of this classic GOP hawk. He's got kind of his most famous thing. He served under Trump the first time as well as his envoy to Syria. His main thing there was really turning the screws on sanctions. He's argued in his time out of government that if we would have just turned the screws a little bit harder, that the Syrian government might have fallen, kind of things like that. He's very classic. And then the second person that Rayburn will be working with, you know, reportedly on this transition, is Michael Anton. And now liberal listeners might know Michael Anton as someone who deeply annoys them because he is kind of infamous for being strongly opposed to birthright citizenship. He's the guy who wrote the Flight 93 election mm-hmm. article that caused a great deal of consternation. So he's definitely a bit of a firebrand associated with kind of Claremont and with some of the, and like Hillsdale College and some of those classic kind of red meat conservative institutions. But he's also got a very America First view of foreign policy. He has argued explicitly that the U.S. should really pull back from Ukraine. He has argued, in fact, at length in an article for The Federalist, that the U.S. should not defend Taiwan in case of a Chinese invasion. So he has a very, very much a narrower view of America's interests in the world than most people in the Republican Party do, and even than most people in the restraint movement do, actually. He's got a very America First view of the national interest, and he's very plugged into the kind of national conservatism movement. So you know, that'll be an interesting one to watch. Does that mean maybe that we're going to see an America First national security advisor? That seems relatively likely. That one doesn't require confirmation, so it's even easier. But it's certainly a sign that Trump wants to give at least some attention to the America First side of things.
Right. Yeah. And there's also, you know, there's some of these figures in Trump's orbit who are trying to be, who are kind of middle of the road in a way. I mean, they might not have moderate positions across the board. I don't mean that. but it's kind of hard to classify them. I mean, Elbridge Colby is, you know, a hawk on China, but not so much on other issues. Even Robert O'Brien, I mean, sometimes he's just kind of referred to as a neocon. I think he's got a little more subtlety or something than the average neocon. I could be wrong about that, but that's my impression.
He's not John Bolton. Robert O'Brien is not John Bolton. Yeah.
I mean, I don't even know if John Bolton's a neocon. He doesn't want to spread democracy. He's just kind of like a radical hawk who wants to like have the most muscular possible foreign policy in relation to every single adversary. So this will be interesting. I mean, with Michael Anton and J.D. Vance around Trump, I mean, those are two people who are very ideological and politically savvy and smart. So Trump didn't have a lot of those kinds of people around him the first time. So maybe we will see something different. I don't know whether that is going to be good or bad or how it's going to play out, but it'll definitely be interesting. And as you mentioned, it could be a kind of counterbalance to the neocons that apparently are also going to be there. But I think that's all for this segment of the show. We're going to have Bob come on. We'll talk to him a little bit before the paywall comes down. And then we'll go behind the paywall. So let's go ahead and do that. Bob, welcome aboard. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you guys doing? Did you do, how did the early part of the podcast go? Were you like seasoned professionals about it?
I think it was the best episode of the Non-Zero podcast ever. I'm biased.
Including all the ones I've been on, including, I mean.
That's heavily implied, but I did not say that.
Well, get clear. What are you saying? The best in the short history of you and Connor going solo, or?
We did a new format, which I think made it the best podcast between us. You know, it was a bit more rapid fire in in our discussion of the stories of the week, which I thought was cool. I liked it.
Crossfire.
Exactly. Like, yeah.
Well, good. So you warming up to this Trump phenomenon? Are you okay with this?
I think I've reconciled myself. The fact, yeah. I, as you guys know, I predicted Kamala, and I was totally wrong. So I admit, quite surprised on election night that Trump ended up winning. But that's how it goes. Yeah. What about you, Connor?
Yeah, I was really surprised. I mean, I had a feeling that Trump was going to win. As our subscribers will know, I was fretting about that in Non-Zero chat starting around like 7:30. As soon as I started to see the results coming in from, like, as soon as I saw that Trump straight up won Miami-Dade County, and Harris should have won that by like 5 or 10 points. As soon as I saw that, I was like, oh God, this is over. It's interesting because the vibes are a little different this time around. I've noticed like the feeling is a little bit less there. Like 2016 felt very sincerely like the end of the world to a lot of people. And this one, for some reason, feels a little bit less that way. And I'm having a little bit of trouble figuring out why.
Definitely less of a shell-shocked vibe, which is, in a way, odd because a lot of people say they have more reason than ever to worry after, you know, January 6th in particular. I don't know. I go back and forth. I got, you know, we had this Zoom call for members on Wednesday night. And I got a little more nervous as a result. I mean, partly because a friend of mine who's kind of a legal expert two friends that I respect, Jim Loeb and David Yellen, were both very concerned about the authoritarian possibility. You know, it's possible. It's going to be weird. One thing I think is that you may now see the longest serving chief of staff in a Trump presidency in history, because I don't even remember her name, but I think the fact that she's a woman Susie may Wiles. Bode well for her longevity. Mm-hmm. I think Trump gets threatened by, you know, I don't think he imagines there being the possibility of an alpha female. So I don't think he gets as threatened.
And there's signs that he defers to her. I mean, she doesn't come across as an alpha female, but I don't know if you saw Trump was giving a speech and then he, you know, went off script and started talking about how if someone's going to shoot him, they'll have to shoot through the fake news first and he would be okay with it. I don't remember exactly how he put it, but that was the idea. And she came out not onto the stage, but like in front of the stage on the side, I believe, and just kind of stood there and he looked at her and then he went back on script. Like it was some sort of signal. Wow. It was the clearest example, I think, of him actually deferring to somebody.
You
got to
find that. You got to find that video. That's a skeleton key right there. That's very interesting.
And she's not like MAGA, you know, she's, as far as I understand, she's kind of like a traditional conservative sort of political actor.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's my understanding.
Yeah, I mean, that's how we started out last time with Rince Priebus. I don't know who served the longest or really how many there were in the end. There was Kelly. There was Mulvaney a chief of staff? Oh, God, they come and go. You know, like, I think Dwight Eisenhower had one for 8 years, Sherman Adams. Mm-hmm. those were the days. There was less turnover generally. That's another weird thing about the modern world. A lot of turnover. Mm-hmm. So you guys talked already, I gather, about the early signs in the tea leaves that this could be a hawkish administration. Did you see the David Sachs tweet today? He seems a little worried.
About Mike Pompeo?
No, he may have tweeted about Pompeo. It was related to Pompeo, I'm sure. And the fact that this guy is heading one of the foreign policy transition teams has done time with Pompeo. But what it was, and of course, Sachs, I don't know if he's a true billionaire, but he's thought of that way in Silicon Valley, Trump supporter. And of all of those, I think he is the most concerned about foreign policy and the most opposed to military intervention. And the tweet was something like, do you think there should be no neocons in the Trump administration? Or I think that, or something. Retweet if you agree. There was a big, like, no neocons icon.
Yeah, I saw this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it's interesting. And by the time I saw it, it had thousands of retweets and even more likes. I don't know what its status is now. But I thought it was interesting that he felt concerned enough to do that. And I thought it was pretty skillful because he, on the one hand, he probably recognizes you got to play hardball with Trump. You got to show him like there's real political power here. It's going to be a problem for you if you pay no attention to it. But I think he also probably recognizes that you got to be careful with Trump, not seem like personally threatening, not seem like you're getting uppity. So this didn't refer to anyone, certainly including Trump, but sent a message. I'm wondering how he'll get it to Trump's attention. He may ask his friend Elon. You know, it was at David Sachs's house that the fateful dinner that Elon attended and Trump attended and so on happened.
Well, one ally they have in the White House is J.D. Vance. So this kind of thing gives J.D. Vance something to point to when he's talking to Trump, because I assume he's going to be the main person in the administration who's kind of trying to resist the influx of neocons.
You know, if it's heartfelt, we don't know. I mean, I just noticed the other day that back, I guess, 8 years ago or so, when I don't know if it was after Trump was elected or inaugurated. Well, anyway, in his anti-Trumpist days, he was writing anonymously for David Frum's Frum Forum.
Yeah, I saw that.
He was writing as JD somebody else, not Vance. And I didn't see a super hawkish post, but I mean, the fact that, you know, he was kind of in bed with Frum, I mean, Frum is about as hardcore as your neocons get. It's unclear to me what J.D. Vance actually believes. He's been a lot of places in his life.
Yeah, that's tough though, because if you're a person who wanted to succeed in Republican politics a few years ago, you were going to need to be a lot more hawkish on foreign policy than is now allowed, right? So it's kind of hard to tell either direction, right? Like,
right. Because you could say the opposite now. Like, you gotta act, like a American first, sure.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think when he was writing for Frum, he was kind of trying out his, like, political philosophy skills. I mean, that most of his posts, as far as the ones that I saw, were him trying to take kind of from that vantage point a view of politics. I don't know if he got deeply into foreign policy. You know, I was listening to this because I'm just trying to learn about these people in a bit more detail than I had previously now that Trump got reelected. And I was listening to this discussion that Vance had at the American Conservative with Rod Dreher like a few years ago. back before J.D. Vance was totally on board with the, you know, Trump team. And he sounds really smart to me. Like, I don't think I had fully appreciated that.
No, he is smart.
And he also doesn't sound like a neocon. At no point in that discussion did he. He did sound like a China hawk. And he said one of the things he liked about Trump is that Trump recognized that we need to have this kind of nationalist approach to dealing with China, and the economic populism is part of that, you know, so that includes some kind of decoupling. So I do think he's a sincere China hawk, and that seems to be relatively consistent for him.
Everybody's a China hawk now, and right. He may be a sincere one. I don't think there are all that many insincere ones, actually. I don't know. It's amazing. China hawkism has swept the nation.
But,
so, Bob, you had mentioned that you had a couple of thoughts.
Yeah,
I don't know if you've already said them. Having some bandwidth issues, Connor. But, Bob, you mentioned that you might have wanted to say a couple of things about the Trump election. I don't know if you already mentioned them. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
I pretty much mentioned them. I mean, I went over it pretty thoroughly with Paul Bloom in the podcast I just did with him. I mean, that was kind of my postmortem. I guess since then I have... It has seemed a little clearer to me. I mean, you tell me, but in my ecosystem, kind of the conventional wisdom is that Democrats have to really take it a little easy on the wokeism going forward. In fact, I would say that seems to be more settled consensus than immigration, even. I've definitely heard more about that than about immigration. I mean, I gather that one of the killer ads, I don't see ads in my state, but for Kamala, kind of combined the two. It was, I mean, do they actually have her on videotape saying the government should support transgender surgery for undocumented migrants who are being detained in America? I mean, that's the trifecta, okay? The transgender surgery, government pays for it. They pay for it even for illegal aliens. That's like, if I'd known about that, if you'd shown people that before they decided to just make her the candidate, I like to think people would have said, oh, God, this is hopeless. They're just gonna.
I've heard some Republican strategists, and it is true. Like, the ad was true. Kamala did say that. I heard some Republican strategists say that they were having trouble with the ad, and they weren't sure whether to run it, and they weren't getting the response that they had quite anticipated just because it seemed so outlandish that voters
like
kind of didn't
fake.
Believe it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, But I haven't heard so many people say Democrats have to finally talk a little tougher about immigration. I have heard a lot about the letting go of the wokeism thing. I mean, we'll see.
I think they're gonna shift to the right on immigration personally, because it was clearly a top issue for voters throughout the campaign. Like, all surveys showed that, exit polls showed that people were considering immigration when they were voting. And then honestly, given that Hispanics are trending right, to such, like, Hispanic males are almost evenly divided between Trump and Harris. And I think the overall Latino vote was like 42% pro-Trump or something. I mean, it's astounding. There were signs of that in the past two elections. But I mean, given that, that also kind of changes the calculus for Democrats, you know?
Well, I think it's not unrelated. I mean, you know, Latinos, there's a lot of kind of, you know, religious conservatives, you know, Catholics, not evangelical so much, but who I'm sure some of those, you know, the trans ads hit home with some of them.
Yeah, I think these Hispanic men might, I mean, I'm guessing, but Trump is doing so well with men across the various racial groups, better than most Republicans do. I think that there's a lot of men of all races responding positively to kind of his machismo, you know. That seems to be another factor because still the African-American vote was still in line with historical trends, right? I mean, African-American men were like 25% or something pro-Trump, but I think the overall figure was still like 12 or 13%, which is kind of an average. I could be wrong about that, but that's my impression. Mm. Do you want to talk about this sermonette that you recorded
so,
this week?
So the Earthling, as people have probably already been told by you, comes out today, the Friday, the weekend edition of Non-Zero News, and this one includes a little video sermon that I did. So which I guess by the time this comes out on YouTube, will be on YouTube on the Non-Zero channel, I guess. It basically harkens back to the origins of the newsletter, as I note in a little preface to it. You know, Non-Zero Newsletter started. I mean, I can't believe I've been putting out a newsletter for like 7 years, a little more. It started out as a mindful resistance newsletter. And it was very much, you know, occasioned by the Trump phenomenon. He had been in office a few months. I thought the so-called resistance, the opposition to Trump, was too reactive for its own good and playing into his hands. I also think that that is a little closer to being received wisdom now, at least somewhat closer. And I also, at that point, I just come out with my book, Why Buddhism is True, which was about, among other things, mindfulness, meditation, the philosophy behind it, the psychology of it. And so the newsletter was called Mindful Resistance. The word mindful mainly referred to the more kind of conventional secular meaning of mindful, just kind of, you know, attentive, careful, deliberate, don't freak out. But also, I think mindfulness meditation is relevant to trying to maintain that frame of mind, even when there's a guy in the White House that you really don't like and may terrify you. Sermon is no point in rehashing it. Then we'll have two video sermonettes because it's not that long. It's like It's like 7 or 8 minutes. But it's on the general theme, certainly of not being too reactive to Trump. So I do say in the preface to the video, I want to, you know, I quote the whole kind of the core of the mission statement we started with 7 years ago, which gets into both the importance of understanding the roots of Trumpism and of understanding the whole psychology of tribalism and what you do about that and how you try not to be tribal yourself. And I do want the newsletter to include a little more of that kind of stuff going forward about the psychology of it and how people can, conduct their lives and especially on like social media in ways that don't exacerbate the polarization problem, in ways that might even ameliorate it, and as a bonus, I think are good for your own mental health. There is that sermon. I've tried not to do a plot spoiler here. I've tried hard.
I think we might still talk a little bit more about Trump on the other side of the paywall. We're also going to talk about, I think, the situation with Israel and UNRWA, if people know about that. So we'll talk about little Israel-Gaza stuff, maybe talk some more about China and whatever other stray thoughts occurred to us. But right now, I think it's time to go to the other side of the paywall. So you need to go to the...
I do want to say one more thing, just reinforce. I mentioned this call we had for Non-Zero members Wednesday night. There were over 100 people there. It was just really gratifying for me. I mean, as it happened, my best friend from high school showed up. I actually had very good friends from both high school and college show up. The guy from college is... The aforementioned legal authority has been a dean of several law schools. And then my friend Jim Loeb, they all had relevant things to say. It was the first time, it's so funny, my best friend from high school, I saw him in 2017. This is a guy who went into the oil business, you know, in Texas. Mm-hmm. And he was like a sports star in high school and everything. And I was afraid to ask if he voted for Trump. So I left not knowing. I saw him for the first time in a long time, 2017. And then the most gratifying thing, I mean, look, people who voted for Trump are fine. I love my siblings who did, at least last time I checked they had. But I found out for the first time that he hadn't voted for Trump either in 2017 or this last time. And it's weird how gratifying that was for me. He had voted Republican his whole life until 2016. And he just said, for him, it's just like the character issues. You know, Trump is just like a bad person.
Interesting. So anyway, I don't personally know a lot of this type. Most of the Republicans I have known switched pretty seamlessly to Trump. So yeah, that's interesting. Okay, yeah. Another thing that's gratifying about these NZN member Zoom calls is how kind of like I always feel like the people who show up seem very reasonable and like
it was on this occasion a very good crowd.
Mm-hmm. So that's good. So yeah, if you want to attend those kinds of Zoom calls, which we do every so often, or gain access to all of our audio content, audio visual content, and paywalled Friday issue of the newsletter and other
including
bonus essays,
the rest of this conversation,
then go to Robert Rice Non-Zero Newsletter on Substack, become an NZN member today, and also smash the like button while you're at it here on YouTube, if that's indeed how you're viewing this.
100%. As they say on the All In podcast, 100%. Smash the like button.
Okay, so now we go into overtime.
This was a free preview of Earthling Unplugged. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive audio content, become an NZN member at nonzero.substack.com.